Accessing library computer data.
And to make sure history never forgets the name Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. We're joined by Clay to talk about First Contact. Clay, how are you?
I am fantastic. This is what I've been waiting for the entire existence of this podcast, and I look forward to disappointing everybody.
We, I thought you might open, I don't know how things are out in Somerville, but out here it is hot and humid, and I wanted to open with a 39.1 degree joke, the exact temperature of a Borg chip, but I guess we missed the boat on that one.
Do you know that's how- that's not the best joke, and honestly, if you were any other man, I would kill you.
How hot do you think 39 degrees Celsius is? We're Americans, so we don't deal in Celsius.
Yeah, I have no idea. It's balmy. Is it? I never understand what the when to use the term balmy.
I think balmy is humid, right? It's like it's a damn balmy day. But 39 degrees is 102 degrees Fahrenheit, so that's the temperature.
Oh,
it's very hot on a Borg ship for some reason.
Well, it's going to get there before the end of this podcast, I think, because all the air conditioning and fans are off, and it is balmy in my house right now.
We do it for the listener. Anyway, we're going to be talking about First Contact, as I mentioned, which is the second TNG movie, the eighth Star Trek movie overall. It was directed by Jonathan Frakes. Screenplay goes to Brendan Braga and Ronald D. Moore. It came out on November 22nd, 1996. For a budget of $45 million. And this is the one where the Borg go back in time, try to influence First Contact, and Picard goes on a journey of Ahab-like proportions to try to stop them. Anyway, I'm going to play an audio clip. Me and Clay are going to come back, and we're going to break down Star Trek First Contact.
Mr. Data, put Starfleet frequency 1486 on audio.
Aye, sir.
Ship to Endeavor. Stand by to engage at grid 815.
Defiant and Bozeman, fall back to mobile position 1.
Acknowledged.
We have an invisible range. A Borg cube on course 0, mark 215. Speed warp 9.
We are the Borg. Lower your shields and surrender your ships. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service us. Resistance is futile.
All units, open fire. Remodulate shield protect.
They've broken through the defense perimeter. To order.
Lieutenant Hawk, set a course for Earth.
Aye, sir.
Maximum warp.
All right, Clay. So I think that just to lay out the discussion, I thought the Generations podcast was good, but I think that we're going to try to structure this one a little bit more. So we're going to open the podcast with kind of like a nuts and bolts about the movie aspects and then go into the themes in the second half of the podcast. I think that'll keep the discussion a little bit more focused, and the themes, we can sort of stick on one of them for a little while that way. So nuts and bolts of it is my first note that I wrote down is music is good. And then a few minutes later, I wrote, oh, Jerry Goldsmith composed the theme stuff for this thing. So right away, right off the bat, I feel that this movie comes out of the gate stronger than Generations did.
I would agree 100% on that. It actually looks like a movie. And so first of all, you mentioned the music. I noticed that right away, too. I mean, it's especially compared to Generations, which had pretty garbage music,
forgettable. I would have a hard time even. I don't think I ever noticed the music in Generations.
Yeah, me neither. I noticed it. I only noticed it, you know, over the opening credits, which is like really when if you're going to notice music, especially in a Star Trek movie or a Star Wars movie, that's when you're going to do it,
right? Yeah,
and Generations just is really flat. There's nothing special there. It really sets the tone for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, and this one, Jerry Goldsmith is back. He composed a lot of good stuff in this. I think that the opening, it might be the same song, but it's the opening and the theme that plays over the actual first contact at the end of the movie are really good themes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a nice theme, yeah.
Yeah, it's like appropriately fitting for the context, something that I can't say about Generations and everything like that. But yeah, we're going to just sort of shoot the shit about the nuts and bolts of Star Trek First Contact. But I agree with you. It looks like a movie right out of the gate.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I understand the need to destroy the ship, sort of, although this movie has me sort of wavering on whether or not I like the fact that they blow up the Enterprises in the movies. In this case, it's necessary just to make the thing look cinematic. They had to do it, which is not the case in TOS.
Well, they don't blow it up, though.
In I'm talking about Generations. To get rid of the D to give us this new cinematic looking ship.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I like about this one is they actually make that a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, you know, it's not just what happens in the third act. There's actually arguably the best scene in all of Star Trek is about whether or not to blow up the ship.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it actually has a heft to it, I suppose, which is something that we criticize Generations for not having anything to do with that. But yeah, the Borg are back. We go back in time. We do another time travel movie in Star Trek, which is interesting that this has been so many time travel stories. Do you have any thoughts about, did you notice that it's like another time travel story? Obviously you noticed it, but did you realize like how frequently they go to this well?
Yeah, I was thinking about that actually. What's nice about it, though, is they couch it in so much other stuff that it doesn't feel explicitly like a time travel story.
Right, yeah.
I think one of the strengths of this movie is that, unlike even on the show, they have three different plots that are all kind of going simultaneously that are separate and unique, but also connected in the overall plot of the movie.
Right.
And I think that works really, really well.
I think, I think that I would almost say that a sign of the quality of a Star Trek movie is dependent on how well they can integrate the entire cast. We noticed that in the original series movies, right? Like, that's why I think Voyage Home works so well, because the movie's plot allows the characters to sort of split up and they each have their own thing to do.
Right.
And this is the same case where Generations to me felt like it was the exact opposite. There was like, it was really only Picard in that, and Data slightly in that story. And here, I think everyone gets at least something to do. I think Beverly and Geordi probably have the least to do out of everybody, but
even Beverly though has, I mean, she has lines at least.
She does. she talks to the Voyager doctor. That's her big scene, I guess.
Yeah. I mean like her, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. Like her intensity level, she gets to act. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'd agree with that.
You know, whereas Geordi just sort of, you know, does his thing.
He gets to kiss ass for Cochran a little bit.
Yeah. But he doesn't have to wear the visor anymore. So, good for him.
I mean, would you agree that it's just sort of a general print? Like, if we were to write a Star Trek movie, I think an immediate focus that you have to do when you start coming together with these stories, you have to find a way to split the crew up effectively.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you have to find a way to get rid of Geordi.
At least get rid of his visor.
We've talked about that before. Is the, when you have a big ensemble like this, or a group that is, the identity of the group is that they are a group that do things together, you only really get the highest amount of drama out of it when you separate everybody.
Yeah, they sort of, when they separate themselves, it's interesting, right? Because I think that it's better when the movies separate them. Separating them at the same time also reveals how shallow they are, because the characters basically are combined one person in these ensemble shows. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I know what you mean.
The skills are so distributed amongst them that they tend to be shallow and not that interesting when you split them apart from each other. I think it works really well here, just because the action and the pacing keeps moving along really well. But I think it's the one downside you might have is that if you try to load too much story onto somebody, it kind of feels flimsy, which is actually going to be a criticism of Picard's storyline in this movie for me. But yeah, I would agree that like splitting up the crew is a good idea. The movie kind of struck me as surprised that there's not a lot of contact between the multiple storylines. They like Riker on the planet doesn't seem particularly perturbed that he can't contact the Enterprise throughout the movie.
I did notice that this time. I was like, he's really going on, knowing that there are Borg around.
Yep.
He is really going on faith that everything is fine up there. And they just, it's just like a magnetic disturbance or something like that.
I guess the in universe thing would just be, he knows that, how important first contact is, right? He's just got to hammer this on. The script never really points it out, but it is funny that he doesn't seem particularly interested in what's going on about it. Do you know that, originally, the roles were reversed, and Riker, in the first draft of the script, went back to the Enterprise, and Picard stayed behind to deal with Cochrane.
I can see why they would do that, but I also think that they made the right choice to flip it.
Yeah, do you know what do you think your logic would be for flipping it?
Well, Riker is usually the more action-oriented character. But he doesn't have the connection to the Borg that Picard does.
Yep, so,
it makes, it just makes perfect sense that they would flip it like that.
Yeah, and that was the original idea. So Riker would be up on the ship. The original thing was that they were not going to go back to Zefren Cochrane. They were going to go back to like the European Renaissance, which is a little bit ridiculous. The plan was that the Borg would go back to the intellectual revolution of Europe, and they would stop humanity from like trying to, aspire to be something greater than the Dark Ages.
I'm really glad they didn't do that. Cause that sounds like a bad episode of the show.
It sounds truly horrible. It would have dealt with a lot of, it seems like one executive or something was really hung up on this. I think Berman might've actually been that's why they threw the holodeck sequence in, because it allowed them to have a little bit of that costume dress up going on. Right.
I wanted to ask you, what is Rick Berman's role? Because I feel like as of Generations, his name starts popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
And I guess I always just assumed he was sort of the keeper of the flame after Roddenberry died.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I think there are people who don't like him.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yeah,
very true. I'm not totally up on who he is or what the controversy around him is.
Berman is the top non-creative executive of the franchise. So even though he's involved somewhat creatively, like he would read scripts, and he actually wrote Brothers, the TNG episode, the Data and Lore episode. He's generally just kind of, the flame holder of the franchise and sort of the protector and the executive who was in charge of all the series after TNG and everything like that. And also the head executive on the movies. And he had a lot of influence on the story of the movies, but that's his basic role. He's sort of despised in Trek circles, I guess, because it's seen that he kept the formula going too long. And people kind of blame him for being unwilling to deviate from Roddenberry's, and the TNG sort of like, this is how a Star Trek show should look kind of thing.
Okay.
That's basically the major criticism of him. And he was heavily involved in Enterprise, which a lot of people don't particularly find enjoyable.
I can see that.
But yeah, as you've seen, he's had a lot of story impact on the movies, and his name is all over the credits because I think he gets script credits or at least story credits.
Yeah. He's got a story by with, Braga and Moore.
Yep. Yep. So his idea was the European Renaissance thing, which they didn't do, but I guess he still gets a story credit. He wanted to have another story about time travel is the basic point. Braga and Moore wanted to feature the Borg somehow.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind it as a time travel story because it's like time travel light.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's not, it's not a, overall, what's kind of impressive about this movie is that it's a big story, but it's also a small story.
Yeah.
And the point in time that they pick to go back to is like the perfect place where basically the future of the planet is in the balance over the next like 24 hours. But it's not like world destruction kind of thing. It's like it's right at the bottom of the roller coaster, you know, dip.
You're right.
And is the human race going to go back up onto the next bump, or is it just going to break down?
Right. Yeah.
So it's like it's a really nice place to set this, because you've got. You know, two different forms of like people working together.
Yep.
You have a negative form in the Borg and a positive form in the humans, and it's just a really nice. I think they picked a good point to do it. I think it all works together really well.
Yeah, and I think it's besides all the stuff like thematically that you mentioned, it's also a very important event for the series as a whole, right? Like the invention of warp drive is like a key development in Star Trek lore, so it's. It's good to go back. Did you know that we'd seen Zefren Cochrane before?
The actual character?
Yeah, the character.
Actor? Oh, no.
He was in a TOS episode.
Was he really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was. He's in the episode Metamorphosis, which it's bizarre that he is Zefren Cochrane, the inventor of warp drive in that episode. It has nothing to do with the plot whatsoever.
Fun.
They basically stumble upon a planet where they find him, and Kirk recognizes him because he's famous because he invented warp drive, and he has fallen in love with an energy being on the planet. It's a very good episode of the show, but it's weird that that Cochrane is involved in that episode. But anyway, he comes back in First Contact, and he's also in the pilot. James Cromwell plays him in the pilot of Enterprise.
Hey, he wanted to just find a island full of naked women, so he didn't say. It had to be non-energy based women.
We're going to come back to Cochrane's desires, I think, at the second half, because I do want to talk about the Cochrane character and how he's portrayed in this movie, along with sort of the whole like what humanity was like at that point in time. But I did want to talk about the sort of nuts and bolts of the Borg here. I think that this is. Probably the best opening out of any of the Trek movies. The first, in my opinion, the first hour of this movie is really, really top notch. I find that it kind of falls apart once the holodeck scene happens. it doesn't fall apart, but that's a point in the movie where I notice that I'm looking at my watch a little bit more and I feel like the scenes are dragging. But I feel like the opening is fantastic. And I remember talking back when we did the Best of Both Worlds with Sean, that episode, I remember saying that my favorite moment of the Borg in any of the movies in any of the series is their voiceover only introduction where you hear the battle going on over the radio.
Yeah.
They nailed the vocal effect on them. B, what they say is perfect at that point. And I love the whole fact that the scene is set up by the bridge of the Enterprise is listening. And, you hear the sort of like getting ready for battle statements of the communications between the starships, and then the Borg just kind of interrupt all of that to announce themselves. I think it's really effective, and it's one of my favorite scenes out of all the movies, I think, so far.
Yeah. I'd never realized how fast this movie is. It gets going right away.
Right.
There's not a lot of downtime. There's not a lot of sitting around on the Enterprise. Just sort of like, you know, Picard has his dream, and then it's like, oh, babe, the Borg is back. You're not going to go there. And then it very quickly, they're like, well, we got to go help everybody. I do have to say, though, I feel like Picard could have given him the information on where to shoot the ship a lot earlier. Maybe like before they head off to the neutral zone, be like, hey, by the way, I know this doesn't seem like the place you'd want to shoot this ship, but trust me, it'll save a lot of lives.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. That's a bit of information that he should have passed on. Maybe he just really didn't like that admiral that gets blown up in the battle, and he was just hoping that would be the way out for him. I think that the what you're saying about how quickly it comes in, I think the movie actually does a little bit of... It's interesting how little backstory the movie actually explains to people. Like, if you were not familiar with this storyline...
I don't think you need it, though.
You probably don't, but it's interesting to me that they don't go into a lot of detail about what happened. Like they don't explicitly mention what went down, besides the fact that Picard was assimilated at some point.
I'll be honest with you. You can get a lot of mileage out of a drill going into an eyeball.
Yes, yeah,
and actually seeing the lens of the eyeball bend. you could get a lot. That's all you really need to know. I mean, if you see that, you're like, okay, I get it.
It was these bad. These
guys, yeah, did some shit to him. He's not a fan.
It was a bad time. Do you think you like this movie because of its, to my mind, it's the first explicitly zombifying of the Borg?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You think that hits your sweet? So seeing as you have a...
I guess to an extent, yes. But I mean, it's... They kind of under... They don't really zombify them a ton because then they... Because there's no, like, there's no queen zombie in right. zombies, you know?
Yep. And we'll get to that, obviously.
Right. I mean, I think this was probably before I was really into that stuff when I saw that the first time. I mean, it's nice. What I like about the Borg is, I mean, I guess it is kind of one of the things I also like about zombies is they are just a wave, you know, they eventually will just overtake you.
Yep.
There's nothing you can do to stop them. And that's always, I mean, that's always the scariest kind of threat. And,
it's also the hardest to come up with a good resolution for.
Right, right. I noticed in this one, they kind of, I guess to move things along. This happens all the time. I mean, usually I had a thing I would say about sequels where, you know, whatever the monster is you fought in the first one in the sequel, you're either going to fight more of them or, they'll be harder to kill, but not both because that's too hard.
Sure.
And, in this one, they make the Borg a little bit easier to kill, at least their ships. Because I remember from the show, the Borg ship was pretty much indestructible, right?
Right, yes, yeah.
Yeah, and they take out both of those Borg ships pretty easily.
I mean, the second one especially, but it is true about that's kind of the writing problem of the Borg, right? The best of both worlds ends with the fact that you can't beat them in a straight-up fist fight, right? You have to come up with some sort of trick to beat them.
Right.
And this one, they obviously can't do it. I guess we're supposed to assume that Starfleet has gotten better at fighting them or something. Like, that's the geeky kind of reason as to why I would do that. But
sure.
I mean, the other thing you could always think about the Borg is maybe send two ships at once, you know, instead of just
how many ships are there? Is there more than one? I mean, is the destruction of that Borg cube, is that like it?
Right. That's something that they never really clarified. And I don't think Voyager has come out yet to really clarify that, because Voyager does do that a little bit.
Oh, they do.
Yes. In universe, there are a ton of Borg ships like that.
Oh, okay. But, you know, I think it works to their advantage a little bit here, because when they do get to the scene later where Picard is having his big, you know, monologue about fighting the Borg, one of the things that he talks about, like the big thing, is that every time they encounter the Borg, they fall back because they can't beat them.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they kind of work that into the character motivation in the movie.
Right. No, I agree with that about, like, the Borg is the unstoppable juggernaut, and this is just sort of the straw that broke the camel's back for Picard. It's like, fuck it. Like, they're not going to win this time or whatever. That kind of ties into what I was talking about blowing up the ships earlier, because Picard during that scene has a line of, we don't give up the Enterprise, not to the Borg. And it's kind of like, well, this isn't the same ship. You know what I mean? It kind of loses a lot of the sacrifice of the Enterprise doesn't feel as big if you haven't been with that ship for a long time.
Well, at the same time, though, it's like you just got it. You don't want to blow it up immediately.
Right.
You know, it's like if you've been driving the same car for 25 years or 20 years and then you get a new car, you don't want to just like casually run your car into a tree if you don't have to.
I suppose. But
you know, because of all those times you have to run your car into a tree.
It's like American White Hot Summer.
Yeah, it doesn't make it any less you know, painful in your heart to destroy a new car.
Well, I think I would disagree, because we're talking about cars where you'd probably bought those cars, right? But none of them are buying these ships. So if you were given a car and you had 25 years worth of memories on it, and then you had a brand new car given to you, I think you'd cherish the older car more.
Everybody else on the ship feels entitled to a brand new Enterprise. Only Picard is the one who's like, we should be happy with what we have and take care of it.
It's an argument against the nanny state, I suppose, is what this movie is all about.
I do like the new Enterprise, though. I like the design.
Yeah, I like everything about it. I like the way that it looks, like inside the interior and the exterior.
I will say, for 1996, this movie looks damn good.
Yeah, it does.
For a sci-fi movie from the mid-90s, looks damn good. There's only a couple places where the effects don't really hold up. I think, if I remember correctly, they were still using models at this point for this movie.
It's a split. It's the first one to use completely digital starships, but they also use models in some shots.
Yeah, because I mean, every Enterprise shot looks fantastic. I mean, it does not look cheap. They get their money's worth out of the Enterprise. I know the Vulcan ship at the end is clearly CGI. And maybe some of the smaller ones are too, but like where it counts, they did a really great job. It looks really good.
I don't know if you noticed it. I only knew this because it was a Reddit post a couple days, like kind of coincidentally. There is a brief glimpse of a model of the Millennial Falcon in the Borg battle.
Oh, is there really? Yeah. Funny. I saw it subliminally because I thought about that. Just popped into my head when I was watching, and I was like, I wonder if they threw something in like that. Like, it would be funny if you saw the Millennium Falcon in there. Apparently you do. I must have seen it and subliminally, you know, registered picture.
It's way in the background, and you kind of have to freeze the frame to see it clearly, but it is out there, and it's a nice little touch and stuff like that.
I also very explicitly registered Adam Scott on the bridge of whatever that ship is that Worf is driving.
Yeah, the Defiant. He's the comm. There's kind of there's like Don Stark, who is the mobster in the holodeck, who I know from Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's a lot of actors like that. And I feel like there was someone else. Who's the guy who plays Lieutenant Hawk? What do I recognize him from?
Oh, that's Neil McDonough.
Neil McDonough, that's right.
He played, shit, I can't remember the name of the character. He was a big part of Band of Brothers.
Okay, right.
And, he was in Captain America. He plays one of the Howling Commandos in Captain America. He pops up in stuff all the time.
Yeah, so it's a movie with a lot of appearances like that. Adam Scott is the Khan, and the Defiant is kind of funny.
Yeah, yeah. It took me a minute to recognize him, too, because he's not lit very well in that scene.
No, it might have been like, I don't know, I wonder what kind of like where he was in his career when that came out. Obviously, early.
Post Boy Meets World, yeah, I guess.
So, I think we're in agreement that it's like it's good to get the Borg going on. The ship looks great. The movie itself looks really good.
How do you feel about the like? I liked it because it's kind of a cool look, but did you notice the lighting on the Enterprise was like they were shooting the lights down through like nets or something?
Oh, were they? Did it get some, like a grill effect or something?
Yeah, there's just like this crisscross shadow pattern and everything, which looked cool. But as I was thinking about it, I was like, so is the ceiling made out of like cargo nets or something?
They hired a new cinematographer who went back and studied the original TOS movies for inspiration.
Oh, nice.
And I wouldn't have thought this originally, but it does. The ship kind of reminds me of the Voyage Home lighting in a lot of ways. With that, where they're on the Klingon ship in that one, but it's like it's very darkly lit with sort of like that Klingon-y. The Klingons, for some reason, have like a very big like that net effect. What you're talking about, there's a lot of like shadows being cast on things.
Right, right.
And I wonder if he just sort of took the inspiration from that and went forward with it or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I like it though. Well, how do you feel about the costumes?
Good. They're consistent, which is good. They're basically the Deep Space Nine outfits at this point.
Is that what Deep Space Nine turns into? With the black and the gray like that? I can't remember.
They just have like everyone wears the same jumpsuit, but the under it changes. Like I don't think they're wearing distinctly different colors in this one. Are there like turtlenecks different colors? I can't even remember.
Yeah, the turtlenecks are the different color designations.
Yes, that's what later Deep Space Nine uniforms. That's my favorite Star Trek uniform look.
Yeah, I'm on the fence. Like I think it looks good in this movie, but I really like the black body with the colored shoulders.
Like the early Deep Space Nine or like the original TNG?
Yeah, the early Deep Space Nine that they use at the end of Generations. Right. There. Yeah, I always liked that. I always thought that was a cool... I always felt like that kind of was a nice graphic update of the costume, because like the TNG uniform is, it's good, but it's a little bit too, you know, over-designed.
Would you
like
even
it,
say
like it doesn't age?
Right. I would say it's like, it doesn't seem to have any utility to it, the next generation uniforms.
Yeah, but when they move it to the black with just the color on the shoulders, it's like they streamline it. It's like, this is this might not make a ton of sense, but Batman the Animated Series, first season, everything was there. There was a definite style to it. Looked great. And then at a certain point in the second season or third season, they went back and they redesigned a bunch of characters. But all they really did was they just streamlined a lot of elements. Mm-hmm. So they went from, like, instead of Batman being blue, gray, black, and yellow, he was just black and gray. Stuff like that, where they just made it a little bit more graphic, a little bit more sleek. And yeah. I think that's what I like about that early Deep Space Nine costume.
But
when you get to the movies, everything needs to have more detail in it. So I can see why they would go for something a little bit more elaborate.
Yeah, I like the turtleneck thing, I think, just because of the subtlety of it seems a little bit more realistic to me. Like, they wouldn't, like, if it was a real life organization or whatever, they probably wouldn't need to blare the color that much, where I like the sort of understated undershirt is what the color of your organization or realm of expertise would be, I guess.
What about Picard's sweet tactical vest that he wears? I was trying to figure out, is that like, is he always wearing that underneath the other thing, or is that just like, when he needs his guns out, he wears the sleeveless version.
I think it's a special event thing. He doesn't wear that all the time. That's something that he's got in his closet ready for the time when he needs to take that out and actually cock a phaser rifle. A lot of phaser rifles in this movie, much more than I think we've ever seen before.
Yeah. I will say, the one thing that this movie's missing for me that would really put it over the top, I don't know why they didn't do this. I don't know why this didn't just make it through the planning, or they didn't have time or whatever. They make it clear at a certain point that you can beat up the Borg.
Physically hit them.
Yeah, physically. Yeah. And that seems to be a little bit more effective than trying to shoot them. I don't know why everybody just doesn't have hammers. But why is there no scene where you just drop Worf with one of those Klingons? Is a Batleth? Is that what that thing's called?
Batleth, yeah.
Batleth? Why is there no scene where Klingon, where Worf and a Batleth just takes on like 15 Borg and just fucks them up?
I'm surprised he doesn't bring a Batleth out at least for the exterior fight scene on the deflector dish.
You don't want to accidentally poke a hole in your spacesuit.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously
are very sharp weapons.
I would agree. It might have something to do with the fact that apparently there were only 5 Borg suits in this movie.
that makes sense.
I think given that problem, Frakes actually does a really good job of shooting it so that it seems like there's a lot more Borg than that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I was going to say. I mean that makes sense, but they hide it really well, I think.
Yeah,
they don't end up doing what they did in the first appearance where it's literally just like a white mannequin with some black fabric and like a hockey helmet on it.
The Borg outfits have come a long way. I think the Borg look really great in this.
I'm dying. I tweeted this out a little bit earlier. I would love to see the next Star Trek movie be the JJ crew versus the Borg.
Yep.
Just to shake things up. But also, I would love to see a modern interpretation of the Borg, because you can do so much more with special effects and, like, you know, taking pieces out with CGI and stuff like they've done with, you know, like on Two-Face's face in The Dark Knight and all that kind of stuff. You can be a lot more creative with it.
Yep.
I think you can make some really, really creepy Borg now.
Well, I mean, maybe this is a discussion for another time, but how would you modernize their ethos? Would you change anything? We're also going to get into this later, because I think the Borg ethos is important to this movie. And it's a big line in the sand. The line must be drawn here in the sand for a lot of Star Trek fans, the Borg in this movie.
I don't know. I guess so. Maybe we can get into this more a little bit later. But I think one of the reasons that this movie works really well is because when you've got a longer runtime, I guess it doesn't matter. I guess any use of the Borg kind of falls under this. But, like, it's kind of the same thing when you get into zombies, where the Borg by themselves don't work as a, will not get you through an entire story.
Yeah.
But if you have enough, conflict and story, within the framing device of the Borg, that's where the, you know, that's where the magic is.
Right.
So like,
they're kind of a seasoning to another story.
Yeah, and I think they do that really well in this movie because you've—I mean—the Borg is kind of like the umbrella, but you get the character interactions like you do on the Enterprise, where they're all yelling about blowing up the ship and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but it's also the catalyst for what's going on down on Earth with Cochrane and all that kind of stuff. But it's also it's also used as a sort of a what's the word I'm looking for? An enticement for Data in his story that's going on. So
yeah,
like
yeah.
You need something else to get you through a Borg story. And they do it well here. I think if you, it would really depend. I mean, it would depend how they handle them if they updated them. Cause if you just make them a, you know, turn them into the Xenomorphs from Alien, basically,
right.
I don't think it's really worth doing.
Right. Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. It's tough because I guess what we could talk about this when we get into the Queen.
Yes, character. And I mean, I'll branch into that now. I mean, I don't really have many other nuts and bolts, but I think the movie is actually really well. I think it's really well done. It's one of the probably coming off of Generations, especially. I think this is one of the best Star Trek movies so far. Generations is one of the worst, in my opinion. I would probably put this on par with Khan, in my opinion. I think that Voyage Home is still a little bit tighter of a movie than Khan and this one are, but this would be like 2A or 2B based on that kind of a list. That's where it stands sort of for my listing for people who need to go off of that. But I think that the movie works really well. It's nice to have a movie come in at like an hour and 45 minutes after, like, I know we're in like the modern era of every movie for some reason has to be 2.5 hours long, but sometimes you don't really need 2.5 hours. It's fine to be done in an hour and 45.
You know what's crazy? I actually haven't looked this up to confirm it, but someone told me the other day that Dunkirk, the Chris Nolan movie,
yeah,
is under 2 hours.
Wow.
And that blew my mind. I just assumed that movie was going to be like a brisk 245.
A well-paced 245. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess we're 20 years ago dealing with this, so the movies were coming in at the time that they needed to be. I do think that the movie drags a little bit in the second half, and we'll probably get into that. But mm-hmm. The last sort of nuts and bolts thing that I would want to talk about is I'm not crazy about everything that happens on Earth in this movie, but I really enjoy the actual first contact scene. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's really done well?
Yes, I think the first contact scene is great. I love drunk Deanna.
Yeah,
I think that scene, I really like that scene a lot. You know, I like what they do.
I found the balancing between the comedy of the stuff on Earth against what's going on in the ship, I found could have veered into being like a sort of like dyslexic, for lack of a better word. Like it could have been really off-putting against each other, but I think they balanced it well. The tone of both of those scenes.
Yeah, I would agree. I did find it a little bit jarring this time, because it's been the first time that I've sat down and really watched it in a while.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend was kind of in and out as I was watching it. Even she commented on like, oh, that's a hard cut back to something very different.
Right.
So it is like the juxtaposition of the two things is kind of jarring, especially because the stuff on the ship is so kind of like aggressively paced.
It's very dark on too.
Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the stuff on Earth is very leisurely paced.
Yes,
like there's no, there's no like ticking clock going on Earth. I mean, there is, but not to the extent that there is on the ship. You know, it's not like the event, their knowledge of what's happening on the ship is leading them to have to work faster to get something done. It's like that. It's just like, yeah, we got to be done by like 11:30.
Yeah, you know, kind of
somewhere around there.
You kind of made me think that. I just realized this, but it's both of these events are taking place in the same amount of time, right? But it feels like the stuff on the Enterprise happens way quicker than it could have possibly happened, and the stuff on Earth happens much quicker than you think it would, because their whole thing has been like blown up, but they have to launch this thing the next day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the stuff on the Enterprise feels more like it's something that should happen over a longer period of time, kind of. Like the timing of the two things feels a little bit at odds to me.
I guess the stuff on Earth, it makes sense because you've got a bunch of
Starfleet people down there.
Starfleet people with, you know, 80 or 100 whatever years of knowledge working on your rudimentary ship.
Yes.
So you can probably get that thing up and running pretty quick.
They never had any problem with interfering with the timeline, which is kind of a nice touch that they've abandoned caring about that.
But the stuff on the ship, I was thinking, it's like, wow, that man, they take over that ship real quick.
They do.
Like they Borgify that ship very quickly,
which I think fits for the Borg, right? And like it culminates nicely in that scene where it's pretty disturbing, the scene where you actually see a lot of assimilation, where the crew members are being sort of augmented. Which is pretty dark. Like you see a person with his arm cut off basically and getting like a Borg arm put on.
Which is a lot better than what they did on the show where they just gave you like a Borg mitten.
Yes.
And just slipped it on over your hand. Like, just hold this now. This is your hand.
They put you in black spandex and put a glove over your hand and you just hold on to the end of it. Yeah, it's the, I was reading, there's a lot of sort of criticism of the Borg, and I guess maybe we'll move into this in a little bit later on, but my final point would just be the first contact. I do want to talk about the first contact thing a lot, or not a lot, but just to wrap up this section of it. I think it's done really well. It's perfect that it's the Vulcans, right? Like this, now that this is all sort of canon, it's kind of accepted that the Vulcans are the ones, but this is the movie or act of the series that proved that it was the Vulcans that they make first contact with. My only adjustment would have been, I thought that the, when they say hello, the Vulcan comes down, he says, live long and prosper. Of course, the Cochran character tries to do the thing and then he can't do it. So he tries to shake his hand and he just says, thanks to him.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a nice opportunity for a callback to the, I would have given him a little bit more of a human thing other than thanks. And all I could think about, maybe you can come up with a better example, would be the scene in Voyage Home where Sarek and Spock talk to each other and Sarek asks what Spock wants to tell his mother, that he feels fine.
Mm-hmm.
I would have had Cochran ask, how are you doing, or something, as a little callback to that.
Yeah, and also because just in general, that's a funny thing to say to a Vulcan. Yeah.
Right. It's very human, you know, as opposed to the Vulcan sort of very Vulcanish thing that they would say. I just wanted a little bit more of they're two different species with two different points of view, but they still get along. Would kind of be the Star Trek point that they're trying.
You don't want him to just start talking jive like an airplane or something.
We fortunately avoids that by playing Roy Orbison, the whitest black man of all time, I guess. But
this is not enough. This is really worth talking about. But I've probably said it before on the show. I have an issue in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek with the use of Beastie Boys sequence in the first movie.
Yeah. Did you have a problem with Steppenwolf in this one?
It didn't bother me as much. I think because it's an old guy.
Okay.
Because for some reason it didn't bother me as much because it was an older person or something. I don't know.
The only thing I don't know if this has been done yet, but before he plays that, he mentioned something about it's a problem with the ignition, is the button that won't light up or something. And I just want someone to remix it where he puts it in and it's R. Kelly's remix of Ignition.
He just smacks the thing and Ignition comes off. I'd be all right with that. No, I don't know. For some reason, that the Roy Orbison and the Steppenwolf doesn't bother me as much as that Beastie Boys sequence. I'm not sure why. I think it's because
I like Steppenwolf better than Roy Orbison. I don't really feel that Roy Orbison is the appropriate music, although maybe that will tie into my criticism of everything that goes on Earth.
My only problem with the Steppenwolf thing is they don't commit to it, and I hate when they do this in movies where they commit to doing a needle drop. And then they just play like 15 seconds of it and then just dump out of it.
Yep. It should have been blaring the entire time they're in space, right?
Yeah, this was important enough for him to be like, wait, we can't lift off until I hear the first 15 seconds of Magic Carpet Ride. And then Geordi's like, hey, and then he just shuts it off. You know, I feel like you got to commit to that stuff.
Yeah.
I hate it when they do that because it really feels like, you know, doing it for the sake of doing it.
Right, yeah. It's a cool idea that you don't actually want to stick onto. I guess Star Trek Beyond kind of fixes that, right? The sabotage is built into a whole scene.
Yeah, and I actually liked the usage of that song in Star Trek Beyond. Yep. I didn't like it in the first one, but I think it works in the third one. Well, yeah, I mean, that's up for debate. But I think it makes more sense in the third one.
You son of a bitch.
This really isn't the time.
Okay, I don't know jack about the 24th century, but everybody out there thinks that staying here and fighting the Borg is suicide. They're just afraid to come in here and say it.
The crew is accustomed to following my orders.
They're probably accustomed to your orders making sense.
None of them understand the Borg as I do. No one does. No one can.
What is that supposed to mean?
Six years ago. They assimilated me into their collective. I had their cybernetic devices implanted throughout my body. I was linked to the hive mind. Every trace of individuality erased. I was one of them. So you can imagine, my dear, I have a somewhat unique perspective on the Borg, and I know how to fight them. Now, if you will excuse me, I have work to do.
I am such an idiot. It's so simple. The Borg hurt you, and now you're going to hurt them back.
In my century, we don't succumb to revenge. We have a more evolved sensibility.
Bullshit! I saw the look on your face when you shot those Borg on the holodeck. You were almost enjoying it.
How dare you?
Oh, come on, Captain. You're not the first man to get a thrill from murdering someone. I see it all the time.
Get out!
Or what? You'll kill me? Like you killed Ensign Lynch?
There was no way to save him.
You didn't even try. Where was your evolved sensibility then?
I don't have time for this.
Oh, hey, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt your little quest. Captain Ahab has to go hunt his whale.
So let's move on to what I would consider to be the big questions, the thematic aspects of this movie. And I'm going to start it off with my general take of this movie, which I do really like and I enjoy, and I think is a very good Star Trek movie. Tell me how you feel about this. I think that the movie is better as an action movie than it is as a Trek movie. Does that make sense to you, or do you need me to like explain what I mean?
No, I know what you mean. That seems to be the general criticism of the movie, is that it's you know, it's quote unquote not a Star Trek movie.
Well, I think it's more along the lines that I really enjoy all of the action stuff, but when they get into stuff that is actually like impactful on the canon of the series, I don't think they do any of that particularly well.
Okay, I know what you mean. Yeah, yeah, I would agree with you to it for the most part. I like the stuff with Cochran. I think it's interesting because I think both of the storylines that they're doing could very easily have been their own thing. Like maybe not movies, but they definitely could have been two separate episodes of the show.
Yeah.
And
you mean the Cochran and the Borg storyline?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And I think the Cochran storyline probably suffers more than the Borg storyline does.
Yes. In this movie, you mean it absolutely does.
Yes. Yeah. But what I do like about the Cochran story is they do manage to get in the fact that he's very, like, he's uneasy with his place in history.
Yeah.
However, they do kind of, they don't, Riker shoots him in the back and then he seems to be fine.
Well, that's the same
they kind of.
That's the same as in Generations when Data's like, I can't do it. And Picard says, just fucking do it. And he does it for the rest of the movie. It's just like, that's all you kind of need of these TNG things. I think that Cochrane, to me, I appreciate what they're trying to do, right? Like, Cochrane is not the man that history has recorded him as, is kind of the point of this. Like, he has motives that are not like the 24th century perfect view of humanity. He's kind of greedy and things like that. I don't think that his, everything he does in the movie, including the fact that he's apparently this super smart scientist who has invented this revolutionary thing, doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel like this is the guy who would do all of this.
I mean that's sort of the head fake they're going with, I guess. But yeah, he doesn't seem like he's. I feel like they don't commit to him being a douchebag as much as they could.
Yes, he's more just, as you said, he's more just uncomfortable with being famous about this when his whole intention is to become famous and rich from this invention. You know what right. I mean? Like, they write it as, it's another thing that I don't think really makes a lot of sense. So Earth that they visit at this point is supposed to be post-World War III and, like, society is in ruins, right? That's what we're kind of told is going on. Mm-hmm. That's why they live in Montana and, like, these, like, tin-roofed sheds. So that's fine. You can go along with that. How is the world okay enough where he will be able to monetize this invention and then buy an island somewhere?
That's a really good question.
So it, like, the, what's going on Earth, I would have actually, they do lip service where they mention, you know, the Lily woman constantly asks a couple times throughout the movie, what faction Picard is aligned with that's attacking them. If we had seen some of that, maybe I would buy this a little bit more, but it doesn't really, the world that we see on Earth doesn't feel to me like it's a world on the edge and is just on the brink of collapse. And this is the event that saves everything.
Yeah, I guess that's tough.
It's hard to do. I'm not holding it against the movie, but I do feel that it's such an important event that I would have liked a little bit more time with it, or at least, because I feel like they spend a lot of time with them. It's just not a particularly effective use of the amount of time they spend.
Yeah, I guess what I kind of like about it actually is that it's not like brink of it doesn't feel brink of collapse. It feels like it's shit's already hit the fan and it's kind of already dissipated and it just sucks.
For sure, yep.
You know, it's like it's less like they're about to, everything's about to fall apart than it is everything has fallen apart. And this is, he's just sort of like, this is just something that he's doing. Like, he's not doing it for anybody. He's not doing it for, like, it's not like, the faction was paying me to build a bomb, but right. I'm actually building, you know, a spaceship so I can get off this rock.
That would have been worse, in my opinion. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just like, this is just an idea this guy has, and it happens to be the thing that, you know, swoops the entire planet back up out of the gutter.
Yeah.
But I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. I think adding in, you know, more external stuff would have made it too complicated, I think.
I think I agree. And I feel like maybe I'm being a little bit too harsh on it, but these are just kind of like the criticisms that I would like. If they could have redone it, I would have appreciated a little bit more of the strengthening the Cochrane storyline would make a lot of sense to me. I think that it's, you know, it kind of ties into the general storyline in a lot of ways about it's like two guys who are unwilling to sort of face the facts about things. They're kind of mirror opposites of each other, where Picard can't face the fact that it's over and Cochrane can't face the fact that it's just begun, basically.
Right.
So I appreciate all that. I just, the Cochrane character just doesn't strike me as, He reminds me in a lot of ways of Noonien Soong in the Brothers portrayal, right? It's like, this isn't the guy that I would see inventing this. You know what I mean? Like, the Soong is not the kind of guy that I would have expected to have invented Data and Lore, and Cochrane is not the guy that I could see inventing warp drive for some reason.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think I would widen the net, like, environmentally or, you know, that kind of thing. But I think I would, if I were to change something, I would make Cochrane more of a bad person. Okay. Like, even more selfish and even more of just a unlikely person to do it. Like,
you know, sorry, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, because, you know, because it's, he's just sort of like, as he is, he's just sort of like charmingly
curmudgeon
drunk.
Yeah.
And his
shot into my mind, this is actually something I was thinking as I was watching it, was he deals a lot with LaForge and Lily in this movie, right? I was thinking, what if they made him slightly racist? And meeting the Vulcans was sort of like the scene that kind of like he learns that he has to look past it. Like, it might be a little bit too sledgehammer or something, but he totally runs into something who is not what he thinks is sort of the best, or like he harbors some kind of grudge against the other the entire movie, and then he meets this thing at the end and it changes his opinion or something. You know, this is a little bit After School especially, but it ties in the line of, I would have liked it if he was a little bit more unlikable in some way, and like his turn actually meant something at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I guess it's tough because like they do also kind of play that he's, you know, he even though he is kind of talking a big game about being very selfish, he does kind of have hope inside him, that kind of thing. They play it up. They don't do a lot with it, but they play it up a little bit.
Yeah. I feel it's very fickle because he opens the movie with like Lily's the one who's like, we got to protect the ship. And he's like, fuck the ship. And then he ultimately does care about the ship. I just feel the character's not very well written. He sort of ping pongs between those two outlooks on things.
You know what would have been nice actually? If they had, if his main point of contact had been Troy.
Yes.
If they had played up him being like a kind of, you know, sleazy old guy to Troy. And, you know, and basically going along with things basically because he, you know, had the hots for her.
Yeah.
And they get to have a scene where she kind of like breaks it down for him as to what, well, you know, what the future's like.
You know what that is? That's the Mark Twain scene in the Turbo Lift from Time's Arrow.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe they would.
But you know what I mean, though, right? Like I think that would have been an interesting, as opposed to just having scene after scene of people just like wanting to shake his hand.
Right. If they actually showed him why what he was doing matters.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point as well. I think that's another way they could have gone. Cause it is basically just scene after scene of the crew members kissing his ass basically. I kind of understand his opinion because he hasn't really done anything yet. Like they haven't shown him how drastically warp drive changes things. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because he basically just runs into a bunch of humans who are speaking very happily about him. It's not like he sees the Federation or he sees like aliens who are working together and all that junk until the very end. But he doesn't have a good reason to buy into what they're selling him.
Yeah. And as kind of awful as it sounds, if you had his motivation be that he's just doing this stuff because he wants to get into Troy's pants, it actually kind of makes sense as to why he would go along with this stuff.
Yeah.
Like if that was the main thing on his mind, it's like, yeah, whatever. Yeah, sure. I'll help you do this X, Y, you know, so that leads him into realizing why this is a big deal. Cause as I agree, as it's written, they just sort of say like, hey, we're from the future. And he's like, all
right,
cool.
Right.
Let's do it. Yeah. I mean, I guess. until he runs away after he pees and gets shot in the back and then probably pees again involuntarily.
Oh, those damn faces. We don't have time for this. So, I appreciate Riker.
There's a cut scene where Riker just is like, can I shoot him like 6 to 8 more times in an increasingly powerful phaser blast?
I could just physically restrain him. A lot of callbacks to previous episodes. He could just physically restrain him, but he chooses to vaporize him with his phaser. Let's move on to, I think that's pretty much covered everything that I think about Cochrane. Let's talk about the Borg Queen. So why don't you lead us off here? What are your thoughts about the Queen of the Borgdom?
I like the Queen. I think I actually really liked the Borg Queen and Data story. You don't really need it.
I don't mean this insultingly, but have you thought about the Data and Borg Queen, or do you just like it as kind of the, I like it on the surface level, but the more I think about it, I don't really understand it.
Well, I do like it because it's kind of it kind of takes they use it as an as a way to basically offer Data the you know Satan offering Data the apple kind of thing,
yeah.
With what it is to be human, or because the Borg approaches him through physical feeling as opposed to emotional feeling, which is really what Data is after, is emotional, it's humanity. He's not after, you know, boners.
Right.
but he gets plenty of them in this movie. But like it's, I like that because I can't remember them ever really doing that before where they use, Data's quest to be human in a more, malicious way.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they've done that a little bit, but not like this. They've never used like, well, there's a whole nother facet of a feeling that you don't even, aren't even aware of.
Right.
And it can be like a drug and, using it that like it's a long, to quote Dan, it's a long way to go for the ham sandwich of getting him to shut down the encryption code or whatever.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's, I do like it as a, we're going to take a segment of this movie and deal with, and further the Data story. I do like it.
I agree that I think that the Borg storyline is interesting because she, as you say, she flips it to more of like the physical flesh and blood aspect of Data, which is something that only the Borg can really provide him, just because of their nature of being cybernetic organisms. To me, it just kind of adds on to the problem I have with the Borg Queen. And coming into this, I wasn't one of the sort of Star Trek fans that really dislikes the Borg Queen. Like a lot of people find it like kind of like this is where the Borg went wrong kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And after thinking about it and watching the movie a little bit more, I can't help but think that's right. Although I understand narratively why you had to do this.
Yeah.
I disagree that it was a good idea at the same time because it totally kills to me what makes the Borg special. And even though you have to use the Borg, like you were saying, as sort of a seasoning on the side, they can't be the main threat because they're too one-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
The Queen's portrayal is tough for me. Like, what is the Queen to you? In the movie, Data actually asks her, like, what are you? And she says, I'm beyond something you can understand, which is basically a writer's way of saying, I have no fucking idea what this person is.
Or maybe she's just a big Prince fan.
What is your interpretation of what the Borg Queen is?
I was thinking about that because, you know, when he asks her what she is, she answers twice. She just says, I am the Borg.
Yep.
And I wonder if that's their way of trying to, I looked at it two ways. I was wondering if that's their way of trying to sidestep the fact that they are writing a singular intelligence seemingly running the Borg. And I kind of forgot what the other one was.
Well, I mean, here's my idea for how you would improve the Borg Queen or King or whatever. It should be more of a architect from the Matrix type entity.
Okay. I was going to say the way that I would change it was I wouldn't make her the queen. I would just make her a construct.
Right.
I would make her like
the software that runs the Borg.
No, not even that. I would just basically make her the Borg's attempt to honeypot Data. So she's like, She's just a creation of the Borg.
I see.
To fuck with Data. That's okay. The only reason. That's the only like, because they have all of these other like, more or less blunt tools that they use to achieve their goal.
They have like Mega Man spinning metal blades on the end of their hands to cut into things. Yeah,
they are definitely like rejected Mega Man villains. but like you know, so it would be. It would be interesting if the Queen was not a singular driving force of the Borg, but just a creation of the collective consciousness of the Borg to do a more a precision task.
Right. I mean, because – and I think that would tie into – that's the reason that they assimilated Picard. The logic behind that is that we're going to do – for a species that needs – to see authority as the Federation is. We're going to have an authoritative speaker speak for us.
So at the Borg meeting, they're like, well, what do we need to really open our brand? They're like, well, we need a starship captain, and we probably need like a hot chick.
We need some sex appeal. We've got all this analgesic cream, and it's not doing much. We need some sex
appeal. I love these full body latex things, but could we do like an off the shoulder look possibly?
That's my basic problem with the Borg Queen is that she doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of what we've expected from the Borg. And in a lot of ways, it makes the drone Borg feel more pathetic to me than I feel that I should with them. Like they feel more like they're just kind of used things, which they are. If you look at the Borg, it's kind of like this software that's taken over humanoids. But I feel like that's more of a, it's less like they're being used and more that they're part of something than this feels to me.
Yeah. It would be cool if they had done a kind of thing like where her voice starts like jumping bodies or something, like to show that she is not a leader. She is just part of the larger picture. She's just like this is just one form that this entity takes.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's kind of implied. There has to be more than one, right? Because she was on the ship with Picard that blew up in Best of Both Worlds. So she obviously can't be a purely physical thing. And that's what kind of ties into my idea that she's supposed to be like the architect from the Matrix. Like she's supposed to be the software that's kind of running everything for the Borg.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool.
The problem with that is that software can't act like the Queen Borg would act in this movie. It would act much more like the architect would act in the Matrix, which is kind of like a matter of fact, like these are the facts, this is how I do things, and this is why I'm doing them.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't think would have been bad to pair against Data. It's weird to me. Like I like the Data storyline, but I feel it doesn't get the time that it needs to really cook itself all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it, like on a plot level, to me feels just like the writers are just like, all right, we'll have him do this, then he's going to flip, then he's going to flip again, and then he's going to flip for real the last time. You know what I mean?
Flippy for real.
It's a lot of, like, you know, Data admits at the end, he's like, oh, I fell for this for like 0.6 seconds or whatever. But Data's never convinced enough, in my opinion, through the movie to make it matter what he does.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think if one negative across the board in this movie is probably that these subplots that they're going on could be their own thing, but they just don't have the time to flesh them out into their own thing.
Yeah.
That
ties into my critique of the Picard storyline here, which carries the entire movie, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's a weakness in taking you start to see the cracks of the TNG episodic nature when they have stuff that deals with the Borg here, right? Like Picard is normal. Oh, the Borg appear. Oh, he's unhinged all of a sudden. It's tough to, I always have a tough time buying his turn when it seems like he's just fickle enough to be motivated by the appearance of the Borg and it had no other lasting impact. This is like a total illegitimate criticism of like how the show actually worked and stuff like that. But it always strikes me as he's totally, totally normal. Borg appear. Oh, he's lost his shit. And he's totally over the edge. And I kind of have to hold it against the movie that this is yet another Ahab theme right after Wrath of Khan.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't love the Ahab thing. So I'm fine that they use it in the movie, but I don't know if I would call it explicitly like an Ahab movie.
And you're talking like, about this movie still.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Because it's not like, well, I guess he does kind of hunt them down a little bit. But it's like the finding and destroying the Borg is not the driving force of Picard's life.
Right.
It's just the driving force of the current situation that he's in. So I don't mind that they use it as an illusion in that moment because it does allow him to recognize how intense he's being and take a step back to look at the greater good.
Right.
So I think it, I don't think it's as overt as it is in Khan, where it's like that's destroying Kirk is literally the only thing on
sure.
Khan's mind.
Like, yeah, Khan is almost costing himself in other ways by his pursuit, where Picard kind of is, but not like the pursuit of the Borg feels more appropriate for what's actually going on in the movie in a lot of ways than Khan's sort of hunting down Kirk.
And I love his reaction to the Borg. I really like his attitude change because I feel like it gives him you get to see a side of him that you don't see in the show.
Yeah.
Because you don't really get to spend the time with him in this situation involved with something that has affected him in the way that they have because of the episodic nature of the show. So I mean, like you said, it's tough to level that criticism because it's, you know, that's just how the show was.
Yes. Yeah.
But I can ignore that and take the movie as like something that exists outside of that framework.
Right.
And it's a mindset that has always been there and makes sense for him to have. It's just not something that they ever got to explore in the show because of the way it was structured.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I would say that they actually, like, the episode that actually probably deals with it would be I, Borg, the episode of the show where he doesn't quite go full first contact on it, but, like, he definitely, it's an episode that explores that he's still angry at the Borg. Mm-hmm. And so I think
I would be.
it still ties in with this movie. I don't think it's totally out of place. It's more funny to me that so much time will pass between the events and then you go back to it. It's kind of a silly criticism, but it's something that always kind of takes me out of it a little bit.
It's PTSD. It doesn't pop up all the time, but right. You know, sometimes it gets triggered and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and then you break your little ships. What do you think of?
I as a kid and even still today love that the case of ships.
Yeah.
Every time I watch the movie, I wish they had spent more time showing it to you because I desperately want to see them. I don't know why. Because it's like I like the. I'm a big fan of you know, as I said before, different uniforms and different stuff like that. So seeing all the ships there,
it's a cool thing.
Yeah, they definitely upgraded it from the one that was on the Enterprise D, which I'm pretty sure was just like, you know,
was melted like, bronze like, statues.
Yeah, it was like a cake mold, I think, that somebody found in the basement.
Yeah, those are terrible. These are actually pretty nice, although it ties into me. Patrick Stewart, not a great actor at looking like he's going to hit something with a gun.
That's in general something I wanted to bring up. I guess I'll bring it up after this. Him yelling no and then cut to him smashing the window doesn't make a lot of like spatial sense because he's facing away from the glass case.
Yeah.
And then the shot of him breaking the case is very clearly like someone standing parallel to the case.
Yeah, backhanding.
And like backhanding it. Yep. And it's not really a dramatic way to do it. I'm really surprised that they did it that way. I mean, maybe it was the best way to get the case into the shot and have like, because like if he's facing the case, then his body's probably going to be in front of the camera or something. So maybe, but it just looks as a movement, it doesn't really work.
Yeah, I think I'll cut Patrick Stewart a break. I think Frakes isn't good at filming. The same on the holodeck when he's about to hit the dead Borg with the gun. It's a bad shot. It's an action shot that focuses on one shot too long. Mm-hmm. And it looks cheesy to see Patrick Stewart running up with a gun over his head going like, ah!
Yeah. I was going to say, I think Frakes did a great job with this movie overall.
Yeah.
I don't think the action scenes are very good.
Right, yeah. He's not really an action scene shooter in a lot of ways. Like, he never had to do it on the show and everything like that.
Yeah.
And,
like, they're fine. They work. But it's like, if you're really watching them, it's very... They're very stiff and they're not. They don't look great.
There's not enough cuts. He didn't. If the editor is not to blame, is that Frakes didn't shoot enough coverage of the action scenes.
Yeah.
And I think that the. What do you think of Patrick Stewart's acting in this movie? I feel he's a notch below what he usually can do.
I don't know. Because, I mean, I think that the whole sequence from the bridge of the ship where he gets in Worf's face.
That's through excellent, the,
through the argument with Lily is possibly my favorite sequence in all of Star Trek.
Oh, interesting. I find the Lily argument to be kind of weak, and I don't... I think it's the performance, but I'm having a hard time pinning down why. But, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I guess it's for me, it's both of those scenes together, I think, work really well together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like the... I mean, the monologue that he gives about every time they run into the Borg, they fall back, and the line must be drawn here, and all. I think all that stuff is I love that stuff. I think it's great
because
it's a verbalization of stuff that you don't really ever get to hear in Star Trek. They don't really ever talk like that, especially Picard.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
And getting him to finally he's usually such a reserved and measured character. And when he's not, it's usually a lot more over the top where he's just kind of like, right, yeah. You know, there's not a lot of like ramping up to intensity for Picard. It's kind of like either all or nothing.
Yeah.
And to get to see him work through his frustration and anger and all that kind of stuff with the Borg and the shit that he says to Worf, which is, you know, badass.
Yeah.
Although I do think it kind of confirms the fact that even in universe, Worf is kind of a pussy.
Yeah. I think this movie actually does a disservice to Worf in a lot of ways. He's very willing to give up very quickly.
Yeah, we've kind of joked about him being he's kind of like a Klingon hipster where he didn't really grow up in that culture, but he just like loves it.
Right.
And like Picard calling him out as being a coward, it was at first I was like, you know, is Picard just confirming that Worf isn't really a badass? He's just kind of thinks that he is.
There's a couple scenes here when Picard is like, we're going to go out and fucking kick some ass in the anti-gravity suits. Worf is like, I got sick last time I did that. Like, which is not a good look for a Klingon warrior. And then, yeah, he gets called a coward. He's got a good response there, but I think Worf is generally underserved in this movie in a lot of ways, even though he's pretty prominent throughout the entire thing.
He does get to do one thing that does kind of make up for the lack of like a really badass Worf scene is when he ties off his suit using the arm of the Borg.
Yeah,
that's pretty. Yep. That was pretty great.
Although it's followed by assimilate this, which is a pretty terrible line.
Yeah, again, Worf is a nerd. He's not a fighter.
That's right. Yeah.
But you know, it's interesting that you say that about him in general in the movie, because I was watching some of the behind the scenes stuff on Generations, and I guess Michael Dorn had a big problem with the walk the plank scene in on the boat where he gets dropped into the water, because he has a very he said he was very reticent to do anything that made Worf look foolish,
mm-hmm.
and I was thinking 90% of the shit they do with Worf makes him look foolish.
Yeah,
so I don't know what kind of muscle he was trying to flex there, but I feel like in this movie too, it's like he's just sort of he doesn't get the best stuff to do.
I will say his scenes on the Defiant are excellent, where he's once the ship is damaged, he's like fuck it, we're gonna ram them, which I think is a good Worf turn. The Defiant will show up in Deep Space Nine, obviously. I think that he's. And that's going to be another running joke about how in the TNG movies going forward, they can get Worf back onto the Enterprise. It's always going to be a big thing. I think that the Picard stuff, I don't disagree. Like all my criticisms of this movie are not really full hearted for me. It's more like they're kind of like things that I would just minorly improve about it. I think it all works well. I think that the Picard stuff is good.
Yeah. The other thing that I love about the Picard and Lily scene is when she calls him out on, like, they make it a point for Picard to talk about how, you know, humans in the future are kind of evolved and all that kind of shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And she makes it a point to point out the fact that he's not acting that way. He's just acting like someone who's looking for revenge. And
right.
I really like that.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
That's something, again, that when they do it in the show, they tend not to verbalize it. And then you start going like, well, these people are talking about being all cultured and advanced, but they're still acting like assholes.
Yeah.
So, like, they actually... Her using his own perceived elitism against him, I think, was a really nice touch too. Especially because given the way that people respond to the concept as a whole, you know, as the whole Roddenberry thing of, oh, well, they shouldn't be conflict between characters and all this kind of stuff, to actually use that against a character in the show,
yeah,
I thought was a nice move.
Yeah, it's a very good turn. Speaking about how she throws that back in Picard's face, there's a cell where Troy and Riker are talking to Cochrane on the planet, and they're talking about the future, and it's the Roddenberry future they're describing. There's like they go, you know, in the future, because of the things that you do, 50 years from now, there's not going to be any war, disease, or poverty. And I was thinking, you know, I think every episode of the show dealt with one of those issues. So I think it all still exists. I don't really understand what you mean, but it's that schism.
Yeah, I think that falls into the thing we've talked about before, where shows that have these sorts of concepts where someone is the best at something, usually the characters are not good at whatever they're supposed to be the best at.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Cops, the best cops in shows are not cops who are good cops.
Right.
Crockett and Tubbs are not good undercover cops. Law and Order, those cops are not good cops. They're usually very bad at what they do. And Star Trek has this, you know, utopic society and all this kind of stuff, but they're kind of racist towards a lot of aliens in that show. You know, like they kind of undercut themselves. And I think in Star Trek, it's interesting because it doesn't really hurt the concept, because that's what I find interesting about it is how do these people actually deal with this? Like I find it unbelievable that these feelings would not exist anymore.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I completely agree.
Yeah. And so when you have a chance to like undercut that idea and be like, you know, this is how we picture ourselves, but actually we're still just, you know, base humans. I always find that interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, maybe if you were to strengthen that narrative, you'd have that going on with Picard, and it would somehow tie into the Cochrane thing if you wanted to sort of strengthen that up a little bit. But it brings in something. I was looking at the Wikipedia page about it. There's some like, I don't know if you'd call it academic writing about it, but people wanted to talk about the Borg, and I guess we'll just close out with a sort of minor discussion about what you think. But one of the authors was just talking about how the Borg are unique in that the Federation has made no effort to get to know them like they do with every other species.
Right.
And if you had any thoughts about that. And what's funny to me is that I was thinking about it. We were making the jokes, I think, earlier in the series that, you know, for Roddenberry's Utopia, for when it came out in the late 80s, is actually sort of surprisingly similar to the ideals of communism in a lot of ways.
Right.
But I guess the main difference is that Star Trek, the main theme of Star Trek, I think, seems to be at this point a very like classically liberal idea of individuality, and that you can do whatever you want to do. Kind of like the world is set up for them, for people can achieve whatever they want to do, and they can have whatever goals. They don't have to worry about everything else like that. Even though the setup feels very like communal and sort of collectivist, the individual is still the primary thing. And the Borg are the exact opposite of that in a lot of ways. And I think that's why they're effective villains for it. But it is interesting that the Federation, when they first met the Borg, they immediately gave up on, well, you can never fucking be friends with these guys. You know what I mean? Like, this is just impossible to sort of come around on. And in a way, the Borg are almost the most alien out of any of the species that they've run into.
Mm. Well, what's interesting is if you really look at it, the Borg are kind of the inverse of Starfleet.
Yeah.
Because they're both basically doing the same thing.
Yes,
except the Borg are doing it without any cooperation, and Starfleet does it in a much more
diplomatic way.
Yeah, diplomatic way. But you know, it is kind of fascinating to, you know, when you're saying the outlook of Starfleet, or what Starfleet actually looks like, is it's like it is very kind of communist and very, this is the only thing there is. And it would be interesting to kind of take a step back from that and see someone from Earth who's like, yeah, maybe I don't want to do that.
Right.
Or someone in Starfleet who is a little bit more aware of the fact that this is really oddly conformist, even though the idea is that you can do whatever you want.
Yes.
But yeah, as far as why they don't try to make friends with the Borg, I mean, you can only invite somebody to a party so many times before you just stop inviting them.
Yes.
You
know? Yep. Yep. I think that this author runs into the problem of, I think the Borg are defined well enough where it's obvious why that can't happen to them. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And
they've never. Well, I guess you could argue the Borg Queen kind of does, but not really. I was going to say they never show any attitude in where that would be what the hell am I trying to say? They never show any evidence of that being something that they're at all interested in talking whatsoever.
Right.
Like the Borg Queen is obviously more verbal than the Borg ever have been, but even she is doing it for a purpose.
Yeah.
And she is still holds the same, motivations and ethos that the rest of the Borg does, which is, you know, we're just doing this because I don't actually like you, Data. I'm just doing this to
absorb
you.
And
I mean, there are just some things that you can't reason with.
Right. You know? Yeah. And I think that's the strength and the weakness of the Borg as characters.
Do the Borg have a home planet?
They must. In some sort of canon. There is a sort of like giant structure in Voyager that they visit, which is like a whole bunch of like Borg stuff built together. So I don't know if they have a home planet, but they obviously must. I don't think it's surprising to me that no series has ever really explored their origin in any kind of serious way.
And you know, I do have to say though, as far as Starfleet goes and their attitude towards the Borg, they actually do take the most Starfleet approach to the Borg as they could, given what the Borg are about, because they're constantly trying to overtake and destroy people, and when it comes to that point, there is a fight, and hopefully Starfleet wins, but after that fight, it's not like they're like, you know what, we should probably track these guys down and destroy them.
Yeah.
It's like they deal with them when they come in contact with them, but they never actually like seek them out to destroy them.
Yeah.
Which could be an argument or it could be interesting as to why they've never done that. And it you know, I'm not sure why.
Well, that was the focus of the iBorg episode. They captured
the Borg,
right? And they had the opportunity to send him back with a computer virus in him that when he connected with the collective, it would sort of like destroy them all.
Yes, the Independence Day.
Yes. And so they obviously decided that they can't do that because the Borg at that point had developed an individual personality and they felt that you can't do that. He's no longer an automaton of the Borg. And you obviously bring up the main point that I think is like the central theme of Star Trek, which is your individuality. And I guess the Borg sort of bring that out.
Yeah, I feel like that's a pretty Starfleet-y. I think that's the best they can do with the Borg, to be honest with you.
Right. Yeah, they're kind of like the Juggernaut from X-Men or something. You just have to kind of convince them to leave as opposed to beating them or something. You just have to be like, you should go do something else in the meantime. We'll see you on the other side. That's it. Star Trek First Contact. I like this movie. I think it's my third favorite of the movies after Voyage Home, and it's probably tied with Wrath of Khan in the second spot, so it's one of the top three anyway. What do you think? Where does it stand for you, Clay?
That's tough. I think Wrath of Khan might be a tighter movie, just all around. But I think this is probably my favorite.
Yeah, I think
like I would watch this one. I have watched this one more probably than any of the other ones. I mean, this one and Wrath of Khan, I think probably are the ones I've watched the most.
Yeah.
But like this is really easy to throw on. It's really easy to watch. It's got a lot of great stuff in it.
We mentioned that about Generations, is we're like, you know, you can just put this movie on in the background, but it's a better version of that.
Yeah. You know, to compare those two, I think it's for me, the way that I reacted to Generations, I think is put into a little bit more perspective after seeing this, because right away in this movie, I feel like this feels like a movie. it feels a lot more like a movie than Generations did. Generations just felt like an episode of the show.
Right, yeah.
And I think that, and I think what they do in First Contact is more interesting. They're taking chances with some interesting ideas. They get three plot lines that are all kind of pretty strong, even if, you know, maybe they're not as fleshed out as they could be. They all work. They all work together. There's action. There's character stuff that's great. There's an awesome ship. The villain's pretty good. It's all kind of there, and it's there in a bigger way. Like, even there's a shot very early on where Geordi's like climbing up some ladder in the engine room.
Yep.
And they track back with him as he comes in, out of the engine room. And they make a point to show you how big the engine room is, like how much space they have to move around in the engine room.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we had the money to build the whole thing this time, so we can, instead of just having Riker and whoever stand just outside of it and light it with, like, one light.
Right.
So, like, it just feels, it feels bigger. It feels more like a movie than Generations did. And I think that's what really works for me in this one compared to Generate. Well, obviously, it's just a better movie overall. But it's like, but the Generation just felt so much just like, oh yeah, this is the episode of the show where Kirk shows up.
Yeah, yeah. I think
this feels like the first TNG movie. And yes, Jerry Goldsmith goes a long way to help that too. Because I mean, you know, there's the more dramatic scenes, the music is just really, really good.
Yeah.
And as opposed to Generations, where it's just kind of there, you know, that stuff goes a long way when you can see the two ways it could possibly go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that this one, it's what you say. This one just feels like a movie, and Generations really doesn't. It's just everything's much tighter here. We have scenes, which the one thing I can't get over in Generations is how little the crew members interact with each other in that movie. And here it's built around them interacting with each other, down to, you know, Riker dealing with a drunk Troy, or Picard going back to rescue Data at the very end.
I love drunk Troy scene, because you get like three different versions of the Riker face. The Riker, like, you know, trying not to laugh, but also acknowledging that was like kind of a funny joke face. That's my favorite thing ever.
Riker, Frake says Riker continues to be one of my sort of standouts of TNG, I think. But anyway.
And I have to say also, as far as Frakes goes as a director, he did a good job of not really focusing on himself.
Yeah.
Like in that scene there, especially, he very easily could have like cut in like a close up of him making a face or something like that. But he lets that scene breathe, and he does a good job.
Yeah. He just stands in the background and lets the two who are involved in it sort of hash it out with each other.
Yeah. The one shot though that I think feels like a TV shot is at the end. That last Make It So shot where the bridge right before they kind of end it.
Oh, you didn't like that?
I mean, I like the idea. I just thought it was kind of stiff. They could have moved into it a little bit, you know, cleaner or something, but it felt like a TV shot.
I would have said the same about the last shot of dancing the Ooby Dooby with the Vulcans. It feels very TV-ish to me. I would have been happy not having that scene be the ending to it. But anyway, that's it. Guys, thank you very much for listening. Clay, thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. Like I said, I've been waiting to do this one for a while. And I would like to amend what I said in Generations. I think I would put Generations below Search for Spock.
Oh, okay.
I think I would probably watch Search for Spock again before I watch Generations.
So your bottom would be Final Frontier, Generations, Search for Spock.
I think so.
That's along similar lines anyway. But yeah, I guess you can talk about, were you just thinking about Generations or something, or did this movie just make you realize something in Generations? I guess you kind of talked about how it did that, but you needed something to compare Generations to before you sort of came to your opinion about it.
Yeah, I think so a little bit. 'Cause you know, I listened back to the podcast we did and so I had it on my mind, and then, you know, I think with Generations, part of it is the TOS stuff from the TOS movie stuff feels like TOS movie stuff. Like the costumes are all there.
Yep.
The characters are all there, and the TNG stuff feels like the TV TNG stuff. So like it didn't really feel like, I don't know, it just didn't feel bigger than the respective parts.
Yeah.
Whereas this feels like you know, Star Trek the movie, like a Star Trek movie.
That's a good point. I think that this movie, I was thinking at the very end, this movie feels, the TOS movies had a kind of feeling to them. And I think that this one, First Contact, feels like a TNG version of the movie, where I think Generations was trying to straddle the line too much between them.
Yeah.
And yeah, it kind of blurred the sensibility, where like TOS is always to me more funny than TNG. Something about TNG is not particularly funny to me. Like, I don't know what it is, where TOS was allowed to make jokes every once in a while.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference. The First Contact to me feels like it is fully TNG grabbing the movie and saying this is a TNG movie and not a TOS movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree 100%.
Guys, thank you very much for listening. If you're on YouTube, like in the comments, appreciate it. If you're on iTunes or any of the podcatchers, you want to write us there, it is truly helpful. It gets the show out there. You can go to facebook.com/thepenskypodcast, patreon.com/thepenskyfile for a couple dollars a month to get extra content. We talked about, what did we just talk about? We talked about our underrated, overrated episode, which is pretty enjoyable, I think. You can go there to hear our thoughts about things like Scooby-Doo and AC/DC. Going to be coming out with the Mad Men pilot episode, and after that it's the Star Trek versus Star Wars. We do have our Star Wars Force Awakens podcast coming out soon, whenever we can get together for that, so you can look forward to that.
Are you planning on having for Trek versus Star Wars a person representing each one, or is it just going to be like a general?
Well, I was going to think about Dave, who does the mm-hmm. Star Wars things. I think he would be a good person to bring on to sort of because I would obviously be the Star Trek person. Mm-hmm. Dave would be the Star Wars, and if you wanted to mediate or something like that, so we can come to a consensus about what went wrong with both of them and what went right. And that'll be it. But thank you very much, guys. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with Insurrection. There's only two more TNG movies left. Insurrection after that, and then Nemesis, and then we're done, and we're moving on. Thank you very much for listening. See you next time.